Hello and welcome to the Indiana Lawyer Podcast, your source for news in Hoosier law, brought to you by Taft. I'm Alexa Schrake, Indiana Lawyer Reporter, and your host this week. As always, I'm here in our Monument Circle studio with Daniel Carson and Mara Johnson to give you the rundown on the latest legal news. Plus, I chat with Church, Hiddle & Antrim partner Kelly Fagan about some key things happening in sports law. So, let's get started. Today is Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024, and these are your headlines. To start, Daniel, the State House is mourning the loss of a state senator. Can you tell us the details of the memorial services?
Indiana Senator Jean Breaux, a Democrat from Indianapolis who was elected to office in 2006, has died after a long illness. Breaux served as Assistant Democratic Leader for the Senate Democratic Caucus from 2012 to 2020. Before taking office, she worked for the Indiana Department of Economic Development. Her mother, Billy Breaux, served as member of the Indiana Senate from 1990 to 2006 before being succeeded by her daughter. Prior to her death, Breaux, who represented Senate District 34 that covers the Near East Side of Indianapolis, issued a statement following a months-long absence from the Indiana State House. Quote, "After a hard-fought battle with my health, the time has come for me to focus on enjoying the time I have left surrounded by my loved ones," she said. "I want to express my sincerest gratitude to everyone who has reached out, to my State House colleagues and team, and to the community I have been so incredibly grateful to represent for nearly two decades. I am extremely proud of the work we did together to improve Black infant and maternal mortality, increase access to healthy food and food deserts, protect Hoosiers from rising utility costs, fight for reproductive justice, pass policies to address poverty, keep our communities safe from gun violence, and so much more." Colleagues mourned Breaux's passing. Quote, "It was an honor to serve with Senator Jean Breaux," wrote Representative Maureen Bauer, Democrat from South Bend. "Together, we worked on legislation to serve pregnant women and children, co-authored dual legislation, and passed legislation last year that allows pregnant legal permanent residents and their children to be covered by Medicaid and CHIP." Senate President Pro Temp Roderick Bray from Martinsville said he was saddened to hear of her death. Quote, "I know I speak for my caucus when I say she will be sorely missed," Bray continued. "She has long been a fierce advocate for her district and was always a lovely colleague with whom I truly enjoyed working. Our thoughts and prayers are with her loved ones during this difficult time." Representative Mitch Gore, a Democrat from Indianapolis, said Breaux, quote, "never lost her love for her neighbors or her deep commitment to her district. I'll miss her kind smile. Rest in peace, Senator, and may your mother and family find more peace in the days ahead." For Breaux's memorial services, the family has asked that in lieu of flowers, donations be made to the National Kidney Foundation. Breaux will lie in state April 5th at the Indiana State House Rotunda with a public viewing from 4 to 7 p.m. There will be a celebration of life April 6th at Mount Carmel Baptist Church in Indianapolis.
Thanks, Daniel. A few weeks ago, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear the appeal of an Indiana couple who lost custody of their transgender teen. The parents argued that their religious beliefs required them to raise the child based on the child's sex at birth. The state said the parents lost custody of the transgender girl not because of their religious beliefs, but because the need to address the child's eating disorder. Mary and Jeremy Cox filed their petition with the nation's highest court in September 2023 after the Indiana Supreme Court declined to hear the case. SCOTUS declined to hear the case without comment. Cox's attorney, Lori Windham, and Joshua Hirschberger of the Beckett Fund for Religious Freedom criticized the state's actions, but also expressed hope for the future. Quote, "What Indiana officials did to Mary and Jeremy was a shocking attack on parental rights. Loving parents should not lose custody of their children because they disagree with the state about gender. We are confident that the Supreme Court will ultimately protect this basic right and ensure that parents can raise their children consistent with their religious beliefs," the statement said. Moving on, tomorrow, what can you tell us about a murder conviction and a recent robbery sentencing?
An Indianapolis man was found guilty of murder for his involvement in the shooting of another man at a park in 2021. Following a two-day trial, 27-year-old Keith Bryant was found guilty of murder and unlawful possession of a firearm by a serious violent felon in connection with the death of 26-year-old Keandre Coleman. On May 26, 2021, the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department was called to West Montgomery Park on Hawthorne Lane for a report of a person shot. There they found Keandre Coleman unresponsive in a vehicle with gunshot wounds to his face and neck. Law enforcement used witness statements, social media posts, and data from cell phone towers to identify Bryant as a suspect. He was taken into custody on June 17, 2021. Though Coleman initially survived his injuries, he was put under hospice care in January 2022 and died on May 3rd from complications related to his gunshot wounds. Bryant's sentencing hearing is set for April 17th. In an unrelated Indianapolis case, two men were sentenced to a combined 44 years in federal prison for their roles in several armed robberies at Indianapolis businesses during the summer of 2020. 25-year-old Adam Reed of North Carolina was sentenced to 29 years after pleading guilty to interference with commerce by robbery and brandishing a firearm in furtherance of a crime of violence. 23-year-old William Dodd of Indianapolis was sentenced to 15 years in prison after pleading guilty to the same charges. Together or with Reed acting alone, authorities say the two men robbed a total of 10 Indianapolis businesses. The robberies took place over the course of a month, the first on August 17th and the last on September 15th. Reed was arrested September 15th after robbing a T-Mobile store and a Dollar General on the same day.
Thanks, Mara. At a South Bend political rally, Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita accused public health entities across the state of submitting faulty and unsound data when it came to COVID-19's death toll and positivity rate. Rokita said his office reviewed nearly 145,000 death records, concluding that the state overreported COVID-19 deaths by 10.9% in 2020, 7% in 2021, and 12.5% in 2022, by counting deaths that he said should have been attributed to accidents, drownings, and overdoses. Rokita urged the Indiana Department of Health to review death certificate data, noting that his office didn't have access to medical files. The office appears to have compared COVID-19 death counts reported by one arm of the IDOH with IDOH's vital records databases, but it acknowledged it was difficult to compare it since it could not match a death certificate to an individual from the Management Performance Hub, which maintains data sets for the state. Positivity rates relied heavily on the number of people testing, meaning Hoosiers displaying symptoms were more likely to test, and some, such as those in high exposure fields, were testing regularly, were counted multiple times. This is what Rokita said inflated the positivity rate. As reported by the Indiana Capital Chronicle, when asked, Governor Eric Holcomb said he thought there was zero validity to Rokita's claims. Now, over to you, Daniel, for news about a multi-million-dollar judgment in a federal trademark infringement case.
A jury in U.S. District Court in South Bend earlier this month awarded recreational vehicle manufacturer Forest River, Inc., a $2 million judgment in its trademark infringement case against Elkhart County rival Intec Trailers, Inc. Taft, Decenius, and Hollister LLP announced the verdict in favor of its client, Forest River. The jury found that Intec willingly infringed Forest River's Della Terra and Mountain Design trademarks through the sale of its Terra brand travel trailers. According to Forest River, Intec Trailers began offering and selling a Terra travel trailer in late 2020, bearing a mountain design that was similar to the mountain design used by East to West on all of its travel trailers, including its Della Terra travel trailer. Forest River, through Taft, immediately demanded that Intec cease and desist from infringing its trademark rights. Intec refused, and the lawsuit followed. At summary judgment, the court first ruled in Forest River's favor and held that Forest River had protectable rights on its Della Terra and Mountain Design trademarks. Then, following a five-day trial, the jury found that Intec willingly infringed Forest River's trademark rights. The jury awarded Forest River $2 million in damages. The court also entered a permanent injunction enjoining Intec from further infringement and requiring Intech to take affirmative steps to remove Terra travel trailers from the marketplace. Alexa, what can you tell us about a recent ruling in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals?
The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals upheld its stay order lifting the injunction for the gender-affirming care for minors. The American Civil Liberties Union of Indiana motioned for reconsideration following the court's February 27th order that immediately put the ban in place. Senate-enrolled Act 480 prohibits physicians and other practitioners from knowingly providing gender transition procedures to a minor and from aiding or abetting another physician or practitioner to do so. The procedures banned by the statute include the use of puberty-blocking drugs, cross-sex hormone therapy, and gender reassignment surgery. Judge Candace Jackson Akiwumi dissented from the order, stating that she would have granted the motion for reconsideration. Neither the February 27th stay order or the order upholding the stay provided an explanation for the stay. An opinion is expected to explain the legal reasoning for the stay, but has not been released at the time of this recording. Ken Falk, legal director for the ACLU of Indiana, said the stay has created a difficult situation. He added that they plan to ask the entire Seventh Circuit Court to review the stay aspect of the case. The case is still pending before the Southern District Court and is set for trial on April 28, 2025. And finally, to wrap up this week's headlines, Mara, tell us about what you are working on for our next print issue.
House Bill 1412 was signed into law by Governor Eric Holcomb in March. The bill establishes regulations for the responsible breeding and treatment of dogs in retail stores. It also overrides local ordinances that prohibit the sale of dogs at retail pet stores. I'll have more of the law's implications in a story for our April 10th print issue.
Okay, that'll do for this week's headlines. As always, if you want more legal news, check us out at theindianalawyer.com. Stick around after our sponsor break to hear my interview with Kelly Fagan.
Taft, today's modern law firm. At Taft, we cultivate a highly respectful, transparent workplace that fosters creativity, teamwork, inclusion, and diversity. We couple our culture with a client-first approach, rewarding lawyers who understand their clients' goals and work to deliver success. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
I have with me today Kelly Fagan, partner at Church Church Hiddle and Atrum. In her sports law practice, she actively represents institutions in a broad spectrum of areas that involve athletics, including NCAA rules, compliance, Title IX, and allegations related to hazing or misconduct. Prior to joining CCHA, Kelly worked for the Enforcement Department at the NCAA. March Madness is creating its usual interest, and hopefully your brackets are doing much better than mine. To start, Kelly, what do you see as key things happening in sports law at the moment?
So college sports is really at a crossroads and almost like an identity crisis, because there is a significant push to modernize college sports while there's still a lot of, I think, earnest interest in sort of maintaining the amateurism of college sports and the core of it, which is student athletes getting degrees. And so the key things happening, I mean, it feels like it's something new every day. You've got name, image, likeness, and those rules are changing regularly, either through the NCAA process or through the courts. You have student athletes trying to seek employee status for purposes of collective bargaining, and multiple different regulatory actions. You've got bills that are proposed for revenue sharing for student athletes. You've got Title IX implications for sort of all of that. And then you still have the traditional sort of NCAA rules that are still in the books that you have to follow. And some of those are being challenged in terms of their legality. So there's a lot, and at least from a legal standpoint, there's a lot of different moving parts in college athletics and a lot of tension between where the model's going long term.
And you know, you kind of touched on this a little bit, you know, so Dartmouth men's basketball team voted to unionize, making it the first labor union for college athletes. Do you see this as a trend that's going to spread?
I think it's certainly a trend, and there's a lot of interest in it. There's also an action on the West Coast related to USC that's similar to the Dartmouth NLRB efforts. You know, I think it's a little bit unknown as to the interest from student athletes, if that's really sort of an at-large interest for all of them. I don't know. I was a women's golfer, so I don't know if when I was a student athlete, if I really probably didn't have any interest in being an employee. I was just going to school and playing Division II golf, and I was just kind of continuing, you know, my career from high school. So, but then at the other end of the spectrum, you know, you have football players, men's and women's basketball, that are on TV regularly getting these NIL deals, and it just is a much different experience than what I had. So I don't know if we'll see it pop up, you know, at every school that there's an effort to unionize, because I just don't know if there's interest. But I think there's certainly sort of a push across the country to empower student athletes, and this is one of the ways that we're seeing that happen, with at least more, I'm trying to think of the word, maybe more energy or more momentum than we saw in the past. Previously, Northwestern had taken a similar effort, but on sort of a technical jurisdictional question, the NLRB did not allow that to proceed, that region office. So since then, we haven't seen a lot of that effort, but having two that are sort of ongoing at this time, and just the overall emphasis on student athlete empowerment and student athlete voices, we'll probably see that continue to some degree.
And so the NCAA is facing several lawsuits at the moment. You know, how does that affect the morale of the organization as a result?
The folks that I talk to at the NCAA on a regular basis, I think some of it doesn't impact their day-to-day work. So they just kind of keep doing what they're hired to do. And but sometimes it does, and I'm sure that's hard. I don't know exactly, you know, how that impacts all of them on a personal level. But there's a lot of good people at the national office that care a lot about college sports and are generally trying to do the right thing and maintain the model and the rules that the NCAA membership has passed. I think a lot of people forget that if a school doesn't like a rule, it's something that most of the time has gone through the legislative process, which means the schools at the NCAA have voted for it, at least to some degree, that voted for it enough for it to be approved. In terms of morale at the office, I don't know exactly what it is, but I'm sure it's got to just be you're kind of whipsawed around, where you just have a new issue that comes up that you probably, especially people that have been there a long time, probably didn't imagine, you know, thinking that a court order was going to potentially change how they can do their job on a day-to-day basis. So, but I think that some of the lawsuits that are out there, those are probably sort of more attenuated, so that it's maybe not felt on a day-to-day basis. But you know it's out there, and you know there's probably going to be some significant impact whenever the lawsuit runs its course, or it's settled, or it's, you know, litigated on the merits.
So, you know, you kind of mentioned this earlier. You know, what has the impact of the new rules regarding name, image, and likeness, especially during March Madness?
You definitely see commercials with student athletes in them. Caitlin Clarkson, a lot of commercials. I think I've seen men's basketball players on the men's side in commercials. So that's a change just that the general public can see. And I think that was a significant fear that people felt, that, you know, if student athletes were out there doing these endorsement deals, that we were going to lose the feel of college athletics. And I think that's been refuted for the most part. I don't think seeing a student athlete in a commercial makes you not want to watch the game. If it's a good game, I think people are still going to tune in, and if it's their team, they're still going to care about it. I mean, you've also seen, I forget what company it was, but it's a company that they had prided themselves on being able to move quickly when, you know, a new star had come out of a tournament game or something, and to work with them for an NIL deal. So it's the publicity, you know, it's just the different things you see on social media, and it's the opportunity, the platform. The student athletes are being able to capitalize on that platform more. So when Steph Curry made a huge run in the NCAA tournament, that didn't translate into more dollars in his pocket, at least immediately, for name, image, likeness purposes. And had that been permissible at the time, probably would have been a lot different. He's doing fine now, so I don't think it hurt him too much, but it's just sort of a different view of it. I think it just has opened the doors a little bit more for student athletes than they previously had.
What do you kind of see, you know, in your law practice with name, image, and likeness, you know, in Indiana specifically?
Yeah, so Indiana, you know, we think of it in terms of pre-college students, but the IHSAA still has a rule that prohibits high schoolers if they're going to be eligible for high school sports to compete. There are some students that have said, I'm not going to compete in IHSAA sports so I can take advantage of monetizing my name, image, likeness. But then otherwise, I mean, the big universities are the most, you know, the Division I, for the most part, you see opportunities for student athletes. You see that there's collectives that have been set up by boosters to help facilitate those opportunities. So it looks very similar to what it does across the board. Obviously, for a school like Purdue that's got a good chance this year, that's going to increase their exposure and their opportunities for their student athletes. But I still think, you know, going to a school like a Butler, like a Notre Dame, like an IU that has those resources and those collectives can give students in Indiana more opportunity for the NIL work.
You know, are there any specific, like, you know, NCAA lawsuits that kind of come to your mind, you know, maybe in Indiana or just, you know, some key ones that you're kind of looking at?
I mean, the biggest one that is out there that most people in college athletics are tracking on, but I think the one that creates the most concern is the House case. And that, so there's that, that's in the same court, I believe, that the Alston case was in. So several years ago, pre-NIL, and this issue went all the way to Supreme Court, found that it was an antitrust violation for schools to restrict cost of attendance payments, so above and beyond room, board, tuition. And that number was pegged at $5,980. And so schools, if they had an educational expense associated with that, then schools could offer that to student athletes. They couldn't be prohibited by, you didn't have to offer it, but the NCAA rules couldn't prohibit schools from including that for student athletes. And then that same court where that was decided is the House case. And the House case is seeking, I believe it's back pay for NIL. So NIL, if pre when NIL became permissible in July 2021, is seeking basically back pay for what student athletes should have been able to receive for NIL payments. There's a couple other cases, so I want to make sure I have that right. But I think that's one of the bigger ones. Obviously the Dartmouth and the USC employee ones, and then there's the Johnson case, which is in seeking employee status under the Fair Labor Standards Act and seeking, I think, the past 5 years of back pay related to what a wage would have been for a student athlete. So if student athletes are deemed employees in the Johnson case, then, you know, that opens up things like minimum wage, potentially like workers' compensation and traditional employee rights that employees, the typical employee now has, and making those available for student athletes, which a lot of student athletes, they don't get workers' compensation, but they do have, some schools will provide, you know, health insurance and even catastrophic health insurance for some really significant high-value student athletes. But there's also access to trainers and athletic training rooms. And so it will be interesting to see how sort of those medical pieces, if student athletes are eligible for compensation for injuries in a high-frequency profession that would have a lot of injuries as compared to an office worker, and sort of how that dynamic will play out.
That'll do for this week's interview. Kelly, thank you again for joining me today. To our listeners, head over to theindianalawyer.com to hear our past interviews. You can also find us on your favorite podcast apps. We'll talk to you soon.